I've certainly appreciated many of the recent messages that we've been hearing so far, given on the events to come, not just these in the next week or two, but the events that those days actually picture, right? It seems like there's been a thread in each one of the messages that we've been hearing, particularly the Feast of Trumpets, that there's a thread about picturing things to come. There's a thread about having hope in things to come and really having a vision of what we look forward to. Being able to capture that vision and use it and to look forward to that future that we anticipate so much. So I've actually had the topic of visions on my mind and in my studies quite a bit lately. And it's been, I would say, one of the most helpful topics that really I've ever dwelled on for a period of time, for myself personally. It's been really an encouragement to be thinking about things in the future, to be even considering just visions themselves and what they are and what they do. And so in my message today, I want to take a look at the topic of having a vision. Having a vision. Here we are in the midst of the Holy Days, and they provide vision for us. So what exactly is a vision? And what do visions do for us? What is the purpose? What's the purpose of a vision? And considering a vision, I'm referring to a kind of picture that you have in your mind, a picture of something in your mind. And maybe it's not just a still frame, but it can be a video, and it can have sounds, it can have audio. You know, when you think of something, what do you picture? What do you imagine? Okay, you might call it a dream. It can be of the future, primarily maybe, but it can also be of the present and of the past. It's something that I can see in my mind, and it's detailed enough to evoke some kind of emotion. A vision can do that. When I considered where visions are used today in our lives, I concluded that, you know, we use visions a lot more often than I initially thought. An artist, for example, can visualize their final work in their mind before they even begin a project. If you're going to create anything with any number of steps that it has to it, you know, step one, two, three, and four, and so on, you might need a vision to guide you along of what the end result might be. So if you're landscaping your yard, it's good to have a vision. If you're painting a house, it's good to have a vision. You can visualize the color that's on that house, and that will help you pick the color. Actually, they have software that helps you to visualize the color. You can pick a color, paint your house virtually, and you can go, oh, okay, I like that, or no, I don't want that. You know, let's pick a different color. If you're adding on a deck to your house, you need a vision. What's it going to look like? Rearranging furniture in your house. I don't know how often you do that, but we do it occasionally. You might have a vision of what you want it to look like or how you want it to feel. Arranging flowers, decorating your house, preparing a sermon message. Believe it or not, I have a vision as I'm preparing of how I want it to look, how I want it to sound. Now, it doesn't always come out that way, but it's certainly helpful to have a vision of what I want it to be. Heather works with architects at work, and they design buildings. And some of the buildings they design are very elaborate, and they're beautiful, and they're complicated. And really, it requires a vision of that end result to design and to work towards that goal. She said that the first thing they do is they work with the client and try to understand what their vision is for the project. And if they don't have a whole complete vision, which frequently they don't, they try to help them create it. And then they can make a 3D model of it. And they can show them, how about this? Do you like this? Oh, yeah, this looks good, you know, and kind of virtually walk through it. That helps you get excited for that project and see it. A similar thing happens in the automotive world whenever they come out with a new model, okay? The first thing that's created is the vision for it. What do we want it to look like? What do we want it to feel like when you walk up to it, when you step inside? What will this model be like, whether it's a car or a truck or a van? You know, who are we marketing for? That vision is created in a document by a team, and that document, that vision document, is a guiding force throughout the design process of that automobile. So a vision can carry emotion with it. But what does a vision do? What does a vision do? What does it do for us when we have the end result of something when we're just getting started? I want to look at a couple of examples. The first, not in the Bible, but just to consider maybe a common example that everyone knows. I think of Martin Luther King, right? He had a vision of a future society, and he called it a dream. But really, it was a vision. It was a dream. To this day, his I Have a Dream speech has been powerful, right? It's considered a very powerful speech, and people got behind that speech, behind his vision. People supported it, and they said, I want that. That vision that you have, that you're dreaming about, I want that. And people supported him. I don't know a whole lot about Martin Luther King, like his life personally, but I certainly know his vision that he spoke about. Let's look at another vision, this time in the Bible, in the book of Nehemiah. You can turn to the book of Nehemiah. We'll read about a vision that Nehemiah had. And we'll walk through this one a little bit. In this example, we'll see that visions have power. Visions are powerful. Nehemiah in chapter 1. Okay, this is during captivity, towards the end of captivity, or at the end of captivity, Judah's captivity. And Nehemiah was the king's cupbearer. Okay. And why don't I just start reading it? Chapter 1, verse 1 says, the words of Nehemiah, the son of Hakaliah, it came to pass in the month of Chislev, in the 20th year, as I was in Shushan, the citadel. Verse 2, that Hanani, one of my brethren, came with men from Judah, and I asked them concerning the Jews who had escaped, who had survived the captivity concerning Jerusalem. And they said to me, the survivors who are left from the captivity in the province are there in great distress and reproach, and the wall of Jerusalem is also broken down, and its gates are burned with fire. That was the word he received, that his hometown was in waste. Verse 4, so it was when I heard these words that I sat down and wept, and I mourned for many days, and I was fasting and praying before the God of heaven. And then he prays this really beautiful prayer after this, verse 5 all the way down to 11. And he's searching, he's seeking God, he's asking God for deliverance. He's asking God to keep his word. And then in chapter 2 and verse 1, it says, and it came to pass in the month of Nisan, in the 20th year of King Artaxerxes, when wine was before him, as he was the cupbearer, that I took the wine and gave it to the king. Now I had never been sad in his presence before. And therefore the king said to me, why is your face sad, since you are not sick? "This is nothing but sorrow of heart." So the king could tell that something was really weighing on him. Something was really a burden on him. "So I became dreadfully afraid and said to the king, 'May the king live forever. Why should my face not be sad when the city, the place of my father's tombs, lies in waste and its gates are burned with fire?' Then the king said to me, 'What do you request?' So I prayed to the God of heaven, and I said to the king, 'If it pleases the king, and if your servant has found favor in your sight, I ask that you send me to Judah, to the city of my father's tombs, that I may rebuild it.'" So he asked the king, right? "I'd like to go back and rebuild it." Then the king said to me, with the queen sitting beside him, "How long will your journey be? And when will you return?" So it pleased the king to send me, and I set him a time. So he responded. I said, "Okay, I'll be gone for such and such time." But he also asked for something else. It says, "Furthermore, I said to the king, 'If it pleases the king, let letters be given to me for the governors in the region beyond the river, that they must permit me to pass through it till I come to Judah.'" Right? So he asked for letters, and he asked for letters to support his vision, to support what he's doing. And the king granted him that. He asked for timbers from the countries beyond the region, that they would have the materials to rebuild. And God granted him, through the king, his request. So he goes, and he kind of scouts it out. It says, so down in verse 11, "So I came to Jerusalem and was there 3 days. Then I rose in the night and a few men with me. I told no one what my God had put into my heart to do at Jerusalem, nor was there any animal with me except the one on which I rode." So he went and he scoped out the walls. He went this way and that way, and he saw, yes, indeed, they were broken down, and they were burned. "I went on to the fountain gate, the king's pool. There was no room for the animal to pass, under me to pass. So I went up by night by the valley and viewed the wall. Then I turned back and entered the valley gate and so returned. And the officials did not know where I had gone or what I had done. I had not yet told the Jews, the priests, the nobles, the officials, or the others who did the work." And then in verse 17, then he goes and does tell them. What does he say? He says, "Then I said to them, 'You see the distress that we are in? How Jerusalem lies in waste, and its gates are burned with fire? Come and let us build the wall of Jerusalem, that we may no longer be a reproach.' And I told them of the land of my God, I told them of the hand of my God, which had been good upon me, and also of the king's words that he had spoken to me." He gave them a vision here. He says, "See where we are? See what's going on? See how everything's broken down here? Let's rebuild them. Let's rebuild the walls. Let's rebuild the gates. God is with me. He's with us. He's supported me this far. He's given me favor in the king's sight." And how do the people respond? Where was I? Verse 17. Here's what they said. Verse 18, middle of verse 18. "So they said, 'Let us rise up and build.' Then they set their hands to this good work." How did they respond to the vision? They rose up and built. They went to work. They were excited. And they did build the work. Or they did do the work. They started rebuilding the wall. And it continues on in the description, how each one rebuilt a section. this family worked alongside this family, and this family worked alongside this family, and they worked and worked and worked. And they kept building and built. It wasn't easy. Nehemiah 4, verse 6. It says, "So we built the wall, and the entire wall was joined together up to half its height, for the people had a mind to work." I think this is showing that the people were really motivated here. Have you ever been part of a project where it's just really going well? You get in a working groove, and you're working good, and you just time seems to kind of just disappear, and you make really good progress. And I think that was happening in this. They had a mind to work, and they were in it. They were excited about it. Maybe they got a, bump on their thumb or something like that. That didn't matter. It didn't slow them down. Maybe a blister, sliver from the beam. It doesn't matter. We're just, we're trying to build this wall. We're looking forward to it. The people here took a hold of Nehemiah's vision of the walls being rebuilt. The vision had the gates being replaced. And the vision had God supporting them. And the people made that vision that Nehemiah gave them their own vision. And they did it willingly. They weren't working by the end of a whip. They were excited to do it. They were working willingly. And so their vision went from before being kind of more of a woe is me attitude, we're in this kind of terrible situation, but we can't really do anything about it. It switched from that to, we can do this. We have the resources, and God is for us. Nehemiah brought them that vision. And they did it so fast that their enemies thought that their God had done the work himself. Nehemiah 6, verse 15, says, "So the wall was finished on the 25th day of Elul in 52 days. In 52 days they finished the wall. And it happened when all of our enemies heard of it, and all the nations around us saw these things, that they were very disheartened in their own eyes. For they perceived that the work was done by our God." So what did Nehemiah's vision do here? It gave the people a positive can-do attitude, a goal to shoot for. It gave them something that was more important to focus on than the daily struggle and the hardship they faced. They faced hardship. They had their enemies trying to discourage them along the way. They said, you can't do it, or it's not worth it. You're not going to be able to do this. They threatened them. But they kept working. They kept the vision in mind. The vision that Nehemiah brought was powerful. And I think what was so important in Nehemiah's vision here is that God was a part of this vision. And he showed him that. He said, God has done this so far. He's granted me these things. He is in support of this project and what we're doing here. That is so very important in a vision. David had a vision, King David, when he faced Goliath before he was officially king, I guess. I don't know. You could argue it both ways. If you recall when David faced Goliath, he came into the picture, and Goliath was already there challenging the armies of Israel, and Israel was afraid. They were in fear of the Philistines. And primarily, they were afraid of this giant warrior, Goliath. And they were kind of at a standstill in battle, if you remember. Like one on this side and one on this side. And I think it was 40 days that Goliath came out and kind of taunted them. "Well, where's your champion? Come out and fight me." And that's what David shows up to. David came along and he saw things a little differently than the whole army of Israel. He saw things differently than the king, Saul. It was a different vision. David came in and said, "Who is this uncircumcised Philistine? He's defying the armies of God. Who does he think he is?" Right? And he told Saul, "Let me go up and fight. Let me fight him because God is with me. He's been with me in the past when I went up against the bear, when I went up against the lion and I killed them, when I was watching sheep." God was in David's vision as he came up against Goliath. And that was a powerful vision for him and all of Israel, really. Now, that was a short-term vision that David had with Goliath, but really it was a part of a long-term vision that David had for his life. It was kind of part of a bigger vision that David had, and I want to look at that in detail. Because David had a vision that motivated his decisions every day, that he looked forward to, that he was excited about, and it gave him inspiration in his life. I want to look at that vision. It's found in the book of Psalms, Psalm 27. Psalm 27. Psalm 27, verse 4. Psalm 27, verse 4, it says, "One thing I have desired of the Lord, and that will I seek, that I may dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of my life, to behold the beauty of the Lord and to inquire in his temple." That's it. It doesn't seem like much of a vision at first glance, but it is. It's just kind of short and simple. But there's a lot of meaning in that. This is David's vision for his life. He said, "There's one thing I desire, and that's what I'll seek. It's one thing. I want to dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of my life." What does that mean? I'm going to spend a few minutes looking at that. What does that mean? What did that look like for David to dwell in the house of the Lord? What would it look like for us? What did he see as God's house? We know that David wanted to build a house for God, but he also knew that a physical house couldn't contain God. So he's not talking about building a physical house and then living in it himself with God. What did David mean here? Let's look at some of the elements of David's vision here. What would it mean to be in God's house? What does it mean to be in our own house? What does it mean to dwell in our own house? What about a child growing up at home, in a household, part of a household, a loving household, a godly household? What are the elements of that house? Well, one thing would be there's a master of the house. The master of the house. There's someone in charge of the house, and it's not David in this case, right? It's the Lord. He wants to be in the house of the Lord, not the Lord to be in the house of David. In the Lord's house, David would not be the head. The Lord would be. But David was okay with that. Even though he was the head of his own house, eventually, at least when he was king, he recognized how much greater God was by comparison. He said, "Who am I that you would be concerned about me?" In one of the Psalms, right? He recognized how much better the house of God would be over the house of anyone else. There's safety in a house. I feel safe in my house, generally, right? Our home is kind of our safe place. Now, there's some exceptions. Some homes aren't a safe place, but it's supposed to be. It's supposed to be. In a healthy family environment, your home is a safe place. You know, Heather kind of grew up in a rough neighborhood, and there may be cars whizzing by, crime out on your streets, but, you know, inside your house, there's safety. You feel comfortable. You're with your family. Inside your walls, you can eat dinner. You can talk. You can have peace. You can rest. And David saw God's house as a safe place because he saw God as a protector. He knew God was a protector. And just as he had the confidence in the protection of God when he faced the lion, when he faced the bear, when he faced Goliath, right? The many other enemies that David had in his life, he always saw God as a protector. And he felt safe with him. And it comes out in many of the Psalms that he wrote. Psalm 18. We'll just read one of them here. You can, just about every one of his Psalms, you could probably see this element in here. Psalm 18, verse 2, it says, "The Lord is my rock and my fortress, my deliverer, my God, my strength, in whom I will trust, my shield and the horn of my salvation, my stronghold. I will call upon the Lord, who is worthy to be praised. So shall I be saved from my enemies." Now, I mentioned eating dinner in peace, and that leads me to my next element of a house. In a house, your needs are taken care of. If you're a child in a house, your needs are taken care of. You don't have to worry about getting food to eat. Food just kind of shows up at the table, right? Well, there might be a little preparation. Right. You might put some thought of it if you're a child. You might worry about what we're having for dinner. But for the most part, you kind of feel guaranteed they're going to have dinner, right? And you take advantage of that, and you enjoy that, and you appreciate that, and feel comfort in that. Or clothes to wear. A child in a house doesn't have to worry about going out and finding clothes. The parents take care of them. You know, at David's table, he had lots of people that he fed. And Solomon, even more so. You know what it was like to take care of other people, to have people under his house, to care for them and to provide for them. It was a good thing to be in a king's house, to be cared for. Psalm 23 really shows that. Psalm 23, a familiar psalm. Oh, a lot of these are familiar. It says, "The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He makes me to lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside the still waters. He restores my soul. He leads me in the paths of righteousness for his name's sake. Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for you are with me. Your rod and your staff, they comfort me. You prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies. You anoint my head with oil, my cup runs over. Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life, and I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever." David knew that God would provide for his needs. He saw it, and he knew it going forward. That was part of his vision. Another part is rules. A house has rules. And David understood that, too. That would have been part of his vision. How many of your houses have rules? We do. We have some rules. Maybe no shoes in the house. That can be a rule in your house. It's not everybody's rule, but that's some people's rule, right? And it doesn't always apply to guests, by the way. Okay. But it applies to those living in the house, right? They follow the house rules. No jumping on the furniture. You can tell I have kids, right? No jumping on the furniture. That's a good rule. But not everyone has that rule. Not everyone needs that rule, right? Maybe you have a rule about the direction of the toilet paper, you know, one way, the other way, you know, I don't know. That's a small rule. We don't always follow that rule. So. But we also uphold the rules that God has for us in our own houses, right? The Ten Commandments, you know, those are our rules too in our house, in our household. You know, we support those rules. Well, if you want to dwell in God's house, there are some rules. And they're good rules. They have a good purpose. There's a reason for those rules. Those are laws, God's laws. And by understanding God's laws, we can understand the things that are important. You know, what God values, what's important to him. And they prevent harm within the household. And it promotes peace in the household so that everyone can feel safe. David had a respect for the laws of the house, and he adopted them as his own. Psalm 119, 97. I think I want to read it. Let's see here. Oh, yeah, Psalm 119. It says, "Oh, how I love your law. It is my meditation all the day. You, through your commandments, make me wiser than my enemies, for they are ever with me. I have more understanding than all my teachers, for your testimonies are my meditation. I understand more than the ancients, because I keep your precepts. I have restrained my feet from every evil way, that I may keep your word." David appreciated God's laws in his house, and he took them on as his own, and he studied them, and he liked them. He loved them, as he said here. So in all, David's vision here of God's house, okay, it's really all about having a close relationship with God. It's about having a close, intimate relationship. Dwelling in the house of the Lord means you reap the benefits of the household. It means you're under the umbrella of care in that infrastructure built by the master of the house. It doesn't mean we can just sit back and be served, but rather that we can have the confidence that we'll be cared for. David had the confidence to walk up to Goliath and know that God was with him. He had that vision in his life. So what did it do for David? It meant that when he sinned against God, he sought to mend the relationship. Having that vision meant that when he went to battle, he looked to God as the one providing ultimate protection, because he could trust in the relationship he had with God. It meant that his conscience was pricked when he cut off the corner of Saul's robe, the one of God's anointed. You know, he saw Saul as a fellow man in God's household. It meant that when David was lifted up and praised by those around him, he gave that credit to God, knowing that he couldn't have done it without dwelling in the house of the Lord. So this vision that David had was a guide for him throughout his entire life, not just in the moment with Goliath, but in everything. Now, he made mistakes, But he repented and he went back to that vision. That was a big focus. Most of all, it's what he really wanted. Out of everything, that's what he desired. He really wanted to be in God's house. And David saw himself as part of God's household, in his house. And he wanted that for his entire life. And Nehemiah's vision for the wall, it wouldn't have been as powerful if God wasn't part of it. If Nehemiah didn't see God's hand working in his life to work towards rebuilding the wall, it wouldn't have been as powerful. It wouldn't have been as convincing when he went and told the guys in Jerusalem, hey, we're going to rebuild. But when he said, we're going to rebuild and God's already done all these things, that's convincing. The vision inspired him and others working on the wall to push through those struggles, push through the difficulties, because they saw that the outcome would be worth it. I'll reference Hebrews 11:13, talking about the heroes of faith that we call them sometimes. It says, these all died in faith, not having received the promises, but having seen them afar off. They were assured of them. They embraced them and confessed that they were strangers and pilgrims on the earth. So the promises that they were given by God, they were part of their vision. And it's part of the force that kept them going, that kept them excited. They embraced them and pushed through the difficult things. The Bible has many visions, as I said. This was a very inspiring topic to study. Really joyous. There's lots of visions that we have that God has offered us. Visions of the future that God says that will happen. And we're learning about them right now in the midst of these holy days. These holy days give us visions of the future. I would say, let's grab a hold of them. Make them part of our own visions in our life. Let them motivate us. Let's consider the details in them and think about them. Having a true vision of the future, a vision that we strongly desire to be part of, that's a powerful thing. Visions are powerful. Brethren, as we approach these holy days, as we go through them and we see these visions of the future, so we hear about them, sing about them, enjoy them, let them be a guide for us as we go through our lives, and let them be a guide all the days of our lives.